Mr. Coley, real one. When and where were you born, Mr. Coley?
In Chilham. 2 Bachelor Street. Which still exists.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a miner at the time. And then he fell out of work. He fell in the pit room. And he fell out of work for about a year. And he started to sell them pots and cups and stuff in the Chilham town market.
What was your date of birth?
1331, which is the same battle before.
Had your father served in the First World War, the Second World War, anything?
I had an uncle that served in the First World War, killed in Italy.
So it was in Shildon, and Shildon is basically a railway town, isn't it? But your father was a miner, you said. Had you brothers and sisters?
No, not at the time. Not at that time. I would have had a brother who died in infancy before I was born.
Did your mother work?
No. At that time, it wasn't fashionable then.
What was the neighbourhood like that you grew up in?
Quiet. Quiet. I had a little pedal car that used to kind of pedal around the streets before I started school. I didn't start school here because after a year in the market, my father was offered a job in the city, Hansett City, as a gardener in Shoreford. And we took that and then moved down to the city. And we were there till the Holocaust War.
And you settled down there pretty well, did you?
Yes, yes. I started school down there. And I was at school till I was 9.
What school was that? Do you remember the name?
Banstead Infants, Banstead Primary. And then we had to go to Epsom Secondary School, which is about 2 miles away, right near Epsom Racecourse.
Did you enjoy school life?
Yes, always did. Yeah, always did enjoy school. And then at 1939, or the end, just in 1940, I took me under some shelter one night when the sirens went and went back to the whole house.
Oh, you were there right at the beginning of the war itself? Yes. It was the very early days of the war.
Very early days of the war.
And how old would you be when the war broke out?
9.
Have you any memories of those very early stages of war?
I always remember the headmaster at the local school telling us that, explaining about the sirens, and saying when they sounded, they sounded them on a record of things, and then if we had to go either straight to school, if we were out in the street, or straight home, whichever was nearer. And the declaration of war, which was 11 o'clock, I think, on September the, whatever it was, 11 o'clock, Mr. Chairman, on the radio, and I was supposed to be playing in the street. And at the end of that declaration, we sounded the sirens. And we'd been warned about this, and I ran down, and I fell down going back home. My mother was trying to, because I was still in the street. But it was just a practice with the sirens.
Well, people didn't know it was a practice, didn't they?
No, it just sounded, it was just to get everybody used to the sound. And it was, I always remember the church school I went to, St. Paul's Church School in Manchester. And by coincidence, they called the headmaster Mr. Paul, which was funny. And then we went on from there to Chester School. And one of the memories there was we went to school there, and one morning we got up and we came to school on a big old rickety bus. And when we got there, the school was on fire.
And this was bombing, was it?
Yes.
As a 9-year-old, did you really understand what was happening as regards
really
warfare?
I think our main interest was the news broadcast at the time, telling us what was happening. We listened to those, but we didn't have any conception. One of the things that annoyed me was my father joined the Home Guard, which was then known as the LDV, and we baptised that looked up and vanished. And there was a big roundabout on the road down from Banstead Croydon. It was called the Brighton Road. There was a large roundabout, and the LDV, or the Home Guard at the time, were put under that roundabout. There was a hook on the middle of the roundabout, and they were guarding the four roads that came under the roundabout. And my job at the time, everybody helped. and children were expected to do so. I used to take the tea out in a flask at about 9 o'clock at night. And it always amused me when we got there, because there were no arms for these men. And their father was standing guarding a road with a broomstick. And it always appeared to me to be silly that he was going to guard a road with a broomstick if there's a tank coming. This was just part of a child's deal with the whole thing. But it's a significance of the thing that didn't strike me at all.
You'd have air raid shelters, did you?
Yes, we had Anderson shelters in the gardens. I'd have to help my father put it open, dig and fill the sandbags to go around it. And that's what we came out of when the house had disappeared. And from there, my father decided this was the end of that matter. And he got in touch with a grandmother who lived in Chilton. And she found a house in Elden Lane for rent. And we moved back into Elden Lane.
It must have been terrifying, the bombing experiences for you and the family.
Yes. I think that the most terrifying was if you were in the houses or in the shelters, and the planes were, the dogfights were going on, and the casings were bouncing off the roof. And I think that really, it wasn't most of the bombs. As a child, I realised the meanness of this whine that we heard, and the big bangs. But it's rattling of the shell casings off the roof, finally, the next morning.
Had you realised that the house had gone because of the close proximity of a big explosion?
Oh, yes.
Do you think, oh, that's our house?
I just looked at it and I realised it was a big hideous. We had no footage, nothing. The only building was the back was still at the tops. And from there we moved into where my father worked. It was a big house. He was an army colonel that he worked for. We moved into the service quarters of the big house until my father could arrange his for us to come back to Shilton for Elden.
Were local people very helpful in situations like that?
Oh, yes. I think everybody. We lived next door to a family that had come from Jarrow, actually. And they were very helpful. And local people down there were pretty good. I know a lot of people say they're not friendly over the south, but they are in the dirt, but what I never found any danger.
Was there a lot of bomb damage in your area?
No, I think what the target was, behind most of the big houses on the outskirts of Frankfurt, there was an ammunition dump. And whether the Germans knew about that, I don't know, whether they were trying to hit that, I don't know. We did get quite a bit of bomb damage. But I think it was just a sort of, looking back now, with hindsight, I think it was the German bombers were leaving London and coming back and dropping what they had left.
You would get your gas mask at one point.
Yes.
Do you recall the day you got your gas mask?
Yes, at school, with a cardboard box. And the gas mask came, and then training how to put it on and take it off. And I hated that. And the baby masks as well, it was there, we put the baby inside. I remember doing that in the school, showing the mothers how to do that. But we didn't realise it didn't sit me for some time, really. And then, of course, we had to roll the gas mask to take back, and they had to put a green extension on. So I can't remember really what the green extension was for, but it was some sort of gas that they expected. It had a black face, and then they had to put this other one on the front and tape it on with black tape. For something else, but I don't know what that was for. But I never once used it, apart from we had that practice once a week at school.
Did you have to carry it everywhere you went?
Yes, everywhere. And one of the things I remember, in the blackout, if we were out after a certain time, or after dark, we were advised to carry a white plate, a dinner plate and a tea plate, so that we could be seen with this white thing. It was the same as a reflective coat you can get today, but we had to carry a white pit in the dark. But we had to carry gas masks everywhere. If you went to the cinema, you have to have your gas mask on your knee. I mean, I don't know what it feels like, but I don't know, but ladies carry handbags now, so even for example, I ended up under the string, with a line of string, and they touched the box to carry it. It was terrible. For boys, anyway. I don't know. Girls probably didn't play with it.
What were the games that you played as a young boy at that time?
Well, cowboy Indians, there was what we call the corner field at the top of the street, and it was a waste ground. Cowboy Indians were very, very keen. And then, of course, with the war, it became English and Germans. I remember one game we played, you know, they had to jump on each other's backs on dum-dum, because they were dumb. Ducks off. I don't know if you've ever learned ducks off. But they had a big stone and everybody had a round pebble, big as a fist. And the one that was on had to put his stone on the top of the big stone and he had to try and knock it off. If they missed, they had to go and stand by his stone. And then the first one that knocked it off, then you had to run back to base. But if you broke the stone across it, you were.
And very much an outdoor life, was it for you?
Okay.
The food, of course, would be rationing then. Was that a problem at all?
In the beginning, no, not when we lived down in Surrey. I think the first time we did this is when we came back to Shin. But the first year or more, I don't think there was never much any apart from the lack of bananas and oranges. But otherwise, I didn't know any difference in the first year. Then it started to become bad. Especially trying to run the butchers.
And your ration books, of course.
Your ration books, your points, your ration books, your clothing books. Came back when I was at school, and then if you're a certain size when you went to school then, or if you had a certain size of shoe, you used to get extra clothing points. And my mum was getting a big size in shoe, and I took a size 10 when I was 14. So I used to get points for that. If you were tall, you used to get extra points for jackets and trousers, because you had to get men's.
Presumably your parents obviously saw that you were all right. And
oh, yes.
Did you realise that they would might...
When we got back up here, he was called up. But he was called up when he was restricted in the Royal Artillery. And then he broke his ankle. And he was injured without going back down the mines. So that he didn't have a bad... he didn't have a bad wage. My mother went to Italy because we were now legendary Italy at Angel.
That's the Royal Ordnance Factory at Italy.
So I didn't go very short, much at all, apart from the stringent food. There was less butter, less everything. Eggs were precious. Meat pie was a thing of the past.
Were you down in London in that area when Dunkirk happened?
Yes.
Do you recall Dunkirk and its effects upon...
Apart from the billeting of the soldiers in the British Horrors, I remember all these soldiers, they took all the school halls, the church halls, the village halls, everywhere. But there weren't any houses, they didn't go into any houses like that. And I remember the mother going up and thinking, helping to cook. The army produced the food, but they had no cooks. So the women in the village, there was a village there, it's quite a crowded now. Wanted to cook the food for them, and then they were dispersed after that. It was sort of a short attack, and then they were dispersed. But I remember they took the stairs, and they had no clothing, apart from what they had given. One man had his long johns, I remember he had a pair of long johns on. His army boots and a great coat, and that's all he had.
And being a child, because again, you wouldn't realise just how...
I didn't know where he put them.
How serious it was, even.
And then when we got back to England, of course, there was no war.
And what date did you come back to the North East? And you settled back into Shildon life again.
Well, I settled back I've never lost the chief massive part of the northern massive. I mean, you know, I went down there when I was 4 and I came back when I was 9, so 5 years I hadn't lost it. I was a little bit, but not much. And one of the amusing stories is when I went to school down there, the teacher once asked us to draw something sharp on the blackboard. So the little children were drawing forks and knives, things like that. And I went and drew a cup with bubbles coming out of the top. And the teacher said, "What's that?" I said, "A sharp drink." And they hadn't, didn't have a clue what I was meant by a sharp drink. Well, here, everybody knows what a sharp drink means. But I settled in quite well at the end. I did Oppen Park Boys School and left there when I was 14.
And there was, as you say, there wasn't the wartime activity here that,
no,
that was done. So.
As I grew older, I was following the war. But it wasn't a wartime activity. I remember the Green Arrow Police Station at Elden Lane in the Chapel Hill. But otherwise, I was seeing them marching all over the road and going to different duties. Mr. Cousins with Elden Lane for all that, as captain of the Home Guard.
Did your father continue in the Home Guard, although
he was
mining?
He was in the Home Guard, right? He was in the mines. He was in the Home Guard, so.
And by then they'd be better equipped, presumably, than they'd then be.
Yeah, they had field rifles and things like that.
Did they bring the weapons home, or were they kept
in
a central place?
My father brought these home, but it had to be chained. He put it in the cupboard, and he had them chained up. And took it out when they were on duty. And then they didn't always have the infield, some of them had Ross, Canadian Ross rifles. I didn't know this till afterwards when I grew up, which was the difference.
Did you, although you're still pretty young, did you feel that they were becoming an efficient little force, the Home Guard?
I think they were in the end, yes. I think they were in the end. They put some resistance on it. They were well trained, and I mean, they were keen. That was more, I mean, when they first started as the LDV, I mean, they were laughing stock, really. People used to laugh. I mean, I remember as a child laughing at this thing that I told them about. My father gathered a roundabout or a woodstick. But after that, I think they didn't really become a force. Or they were being directed there.
And your schooling continued through the war, did it? Through the war years?
Yes. Alex School in 1945, at 14, Easter 1945, and I remember the BE day, BJ day, which was my first BJ day. That
was quite a celebration.
Oh, that was a thrill, yeah. It was fun. They reckon they got 250,000 people in which was my first, and I said, we'll have to cram in there, but I don't know how far that's true. But, yes, it's one of those celebrations.
Were you aware of people who were not going to come home, you know, men that were killed, neighbours or what have you?
I think I was more aware of when the prisoners of war started to come home. One called Clark especially, he came to the school and gave us a talk on his being a prisoner in the Japanese camp. And I think it wasn't so much the men that he came back to the school, he came back to the prisoners. Some of the not quite there mentally. I think that's what struck me more than anything else. These men, and I think it struck me later on in life when we come back to Korea when we got across with them on the same ship. I can see the similarity between them. That moved me more than anything else. I wasn't so much moved by those that didn't come back because I didn't have anybody that didn't come back. But I remember those men coming back. Telling the stories.
You left school in 1945. Where did you go?
I went to Rosen's Forge for a week. And I didn't like it. And at the time, there was the essential works order was on. And I finally got released from Rosen's Forge after only working a week. Anyway, I found a money stop, and then I started my building trade as a apprentice bricklayer. And went on from there, volunteering the building trade.
And the company that you started with?
It was just a small local firm with about four men, Richardson and Thompson's, in children. and the son was still in trouble here, and he was chosen one with me for a long time at St. James Church, which I have known.
And did you have an apprenticeship to do that? What did that entail? Obviously, you were going in with no knowledge whatsoever. Yeah. What happened over the 7 years?
It entailed me going to Maxfield and Woodbridge and Holders in Shelby. And then we did the Paragraph and Holders, we fixed fire addresses. So I think I was one of the only ones left now that could fix an old Black Collie Range, which I hadn't done for years, but we did do that. An old big Black Collie Range with a big Black Ovens. But it, I could fix one of them.
Apprenticeships nowadays, of course, don't exist really, do they? And it would be entirely different training in those days.
Yes, it was strict training. Yes. So you have to buy your own tools, which you don't have to do at all. They're provided by the firm. And it costs a lot of money. I mean, I started apprenticeship on 27 or 6 a week. But, 15 in the trade, and to buy tools out of that was a travel in those days was a pound.
And the very first duties when you first went in as an apprentice, as I say, you've got no knowledge, no experience. What were the first things they gave you to do?
Yeah, carry the bricks, you had to seat the tea at 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You had to see if the bricklayers were served with mortar. You didn't have to carry it, but you had to see that it was there. You were put on a mixer or a plug mill, and it had to be right. And that was your first 6 months. Then after that, you were put on the small pieces of pond, brickwork and stonework and things like that. And you progressed through that where you started to build the stonework, build it, brickwork. And then you were shown how to fix a tile fireplace or whatever, a combination of them, an old black combination, how to repair it, how to put the floor down to them. And then you got on to different things like building a garage, and then part of the housing.
I suppose it depended upon the ability of the bricklayer that was training you, was how really how skillful you got, isn't that so?
Yes, I have two very good ones. Bert, which is a very, very good one, one of the fastest and the best bricklayer I've ever seen in my life. But he never walked to reach his standards. But he was very good and very quiet. The other one was a jobbing man. He knew everything about jobbing bricklayers. And he was a strict one. So I'll tell you the story. But I once got to go to him and say it, and he told me that he found the length of his drive by and each other being there on time. And this was the type of thing that you were expected to do. They're pushing the handcarts. You go through the pass where you get one of the standards, and then the handcart, and then a ladder. There's two of you pushing it, and it's sure it's heavy.
Yes, it must have been extremely heavy work for a young lad just coming out of school.
Oh, yes. I think you built yourself up with a lean machine by the time you finished.
The night classes that you said that you went to, what were they, what were you studying for?
It was usually, in the first year, it was English and maths, just as you did at school. And then you got into the theory of building work, drainage and things like that. We went to Darlington, into the old building, which is now a school, an office. And then you had to go to East Bourne Road, secondary school for the other things. And that lasted 4 years. And they had to have you finished another city of years. And if you didn't get your city of years, you didn't finish your apprenticeship.
It was as bad as that, that you must get your exams.
You must get your exams, yeah. And you weren't allowed days off as you are now. You had to do all that at night. You had to go 3 times during the week at night.
That's work during the day and your night classes at night.
You didn't get sort of daily rates as they do now. Three, four months.
And when you got your apprenticeship, how was that? How was the end of your apprenticeship celebrated, you might say?
It was called up straight away. Actually, it wasn't a celebration, it was just finished your apprenticeship, and the firm at that time, firms didn't keep you on after your apprenticeship. It was being a small firm, they said, yes, you can have employment. Because they'd trained me and put all the effort in, they wanted something back. Anyway, I was called, they knew I was going to get called. I was deferred, I was 21. They knew I was going to get called, but I had to go back to them and ask them out, so they could really benefit of their training.
So if you're a skilled, or you're in skilled work, and you're apprenticed to a skilled work, national service was deferred for that period of time.
Yes, you have to go when you're 18, if you're a skilled work, or have an apprenticeship, you have to apply, and you're deferred. The term of us, for the deferred position, when you apply, the name is captain, then you're deferred, and then you're called when you're 21. When I was 21 on January the 13th, and I was called on January the 6th, the day that King George the 6th died. And I thought I was going to be off with it.
What were your feelings about being conscripted in this way?
Well, I knew it was coming, and we just didn't really bother it. And when I went for medical, I had to go to the medical for the medical. And then you were told you were A1 fit. And then you were given an interview, and you were told where you were going, actually. You were going to the DNI.
They didn't ask you, they didn't give you a choice.
No, they asked me whether you wanted RAF, Navy or Army, but I didn't want RAF, I didn't want Navy, so I went for the Army. So they said, I'm going to go to BLI, and you can go to Bransworth, and from Bransworth we go to Berlin. But we didn't know until we got to Berlin that we would have brought back and sent to Korea.
And you called up, what date was it again?
February 6, 1952.
Do you recall that particular day and what happened to you?
I had to get to Bishop Auckland Station for shooting, and there was four of us, two lads from Canada and myself, and another one, and we went to Bransford Camp. There was a station at Bransford there. We went from Bishop Auckland to Bransford, walked into the camp, and from there we just figured out. We didn't know what it hit us, of course, and we didn't know anything about it, apart from getting badly uniform and short old bullets.
That this was when you got to the camp, the reception was,
yes.
You were taken in immediately?
Yes, it was a Sergeant Clapperton met. We were put into this squad. There was a Sergeant who had a lot of this squad, and I had a little Clapperton squad. And right at near the corridor, at the top of Bransford Camp.
And you got your uniform the first day that you were there?
With a uniform which didn't fit, of course.
And how was it issued?
You just held your hands out and the trousers, what size trousers are you? What size waist? 28. What length of leg? 29 and a half. And it didn't matter what it was, you got a 31 and a 34. Right. And you buttonless gloves with two khaki shirts. Two vests, underpants, socks, housewife, and you just held your hands out, it was just piled on top. And then you took it through, and then these two corporals, red thread was one of them, corporal red thread, he showed us how to stow it. We had a box, a little bed, and a camp bed, and then we were shown how to fold it, how to line it. What to do, we were told that if we lost any of that paper, we were told we'd get 15 to 6 weeks.